From time to time, we hold an evening like this. We don't like meet like this every time we meet, but from time to time we hold an evening like this where we take an opportunity to look into a specific question or area of the Christian faith and to ask questions of it. Tonight you will have seen that our subject is, do I have to lose my mind to be a Christian? Our speaker is Paul Clark. He's going to be standing up in just a moment. Paul is married to Emily. He's been on the staff here for a number of years. I mean, he has three lovely children. The middle one has just started school today, so it's a very big day for Paul. So, very big day for his child. It's also a big day for you as well, Paul, but there we go. And the joy of the evenings like this is that we get opportunities to grill the speaker after he's spoken. I really like that. And on your table, you'll find a little question slip like that. And I would suggest perhaps in the next couple of minutes you dish those out. Paul, I know, is going to be speaking from John's Gospel, the eyewitness account of John, and you'll find a copy of that too, so you can check out what he's saying as he speaks on your table as well. Now, I think the only thing for me to say is Paul will be up in about 2 or 3 minutes' time. The next person you will see standing here, I think, will be him, unless one of you is planning, you know, impromptu, but I think it'll be Paul. So we've got a couple of minutes, and then it's over to Paul. Thank you very much.
Well, good evening. Perhaps I could interrupt you at that point. Thank you very, very much indeed for joining us this evening. I do hope you'll do as William said and make full use of that question slip and prepare to grill us a little bit later on in the evening. It would be a help to me if you could take up a copy of John's account of the life of Jesus, and you probably want a pen and a question slip somewhere near you at the moment as we begin. Well, our title this evening is, I think, an excellent one. It's a question that many are asking in our days. If I want to be a Christian, does God want me to lose my mind? Is it a suspension of reason that is called for? Do I need to ask you this evening to do the Wurzel Gummidge thing and unscrew your head right now and store it under your chair for the remainder of the evening? You'll certainly know that that is the accusation that abounds in our culture. Richard Dawkins has been back in the news in the last week or so doing more public debates about his book, The God Delusion, in which he defines faith as blind trust in the teeth of the evidence. It's a striking choice of phrase, not just wishful thinking without much evidence, but blind trust in the teeth of all of the evidence. And so very famously, he says that to believe in Jesus Christ in the 21st century is about as plausible as believing in Father Christmas or the fairies at the bottom. Sorry to break an illusion if you are still here under that misapprehension this evening. He says it would be about as plausible as believing in Father Christmas or the fairies at the bottom of the garden. Or in other words, you simply cannot be a modern thinking person and believe in Jesus Christ at the same time. And for many, I think, in our generation, the default position is to presume that Richard Dawkins is right, and others like him who make that sort of argument. We think, look, he's obviously a fairly intelligent chap. He's from Oxford. He writes books. He appears on TV. So if he says that it's utterly impossible to reconcile faith and reason, then he must be right. And so many don't even bother to look into things because they presume that there'll be nothing there when they try. Well, I want to face that challenge head on this evening, if I may, by trying to introduce us to a character from the Bible who I think we could call the patron saint of skepticism. His name is Thomas. He's often called Doubting Thomas. And as we'll see in a moment, that's because he's one of these men with just a militantly stubborn refusal to believe anything unless he has very solid, tangible, empirical evidence to lay his hands on. And you'll see that. I've asked Georgie, who's with the congregation here, to come up and read to us from John. And towards the back of it, if you flick there now, it's chapter 20, which you will find the big numbers of the chapters, the small numbers of the verses, and you'll find it on page 59.
Reading from page 59, John chapter 20, starting at verse 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name.
Georgie, thank you very much indeed. Could you flip back to page 59 then, and we'll just work through that, I think, a couple of sentences at a time. I'm going to call that first little paragraph "Reasonable Doubt," and I think you'll see why as we just read it once again. Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We've seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." It's reasonable doubt. A friend of mine says that if Thomas was a Brit, he'd very definitely be from Yorkshire. I hope that doesn't offend anyone here this evening. There's definitely more than a touch of the Jeffrey boycott about the bloke, I think. And so he lays this triple condition. He says, "I want to see the holes where the nails went into Jesus. I want to put my finger into the holes, and I want to shove my hand into his side where the spear went in. And unless I get to do all of that, I will never believe." At first glance, I think it's a fairly reasonable request, because at this point in chapter 20 of John's eyewitness account of the life of Jesus, Thomas is the odd one out. You can see that if you just glance back up to verse 8, where we see that the writer, that's John, saw Jesus and believed. In verse 18, Mary reported, "I have seen the Lord." Just a week earlier, only Thomas, in verse 20, was missing when Jesus appeared in their midst, and it says they were glad when they saw the Lord. Then in verse 25, in our passage, they all keep on telling Thomas, "We have seen the..." It's a chapter all about seeing. It's about trusting in your sense perception. And so on one level, we can see why Thomas should say, "Unless I see, I will never believe." Never mind what my 10 friends are trying to tell me. I want to handle the evidence with my own 10 fingers. And if I can't, I won't believe. I don't want some second-hand experience. If I can't see it for myself, you can forget it. You'll see straight away that this demand for proof from Thomas gives the lie to those who say that the only reason that people in the first century believed that Jesus rose from the dead was because they were all naive and gullible. Oh yeah, people tend to say, well, back then they would believe anything, but not us. We're far too sophisticated for that. Actually, that's complete rubbish. It's an attitude that C.S. Lewis famously called chronological snobbery. The mortality rate back in the first century was much the same as it is today, and the percentage of people who remained dead after their demise was exactly the same as it is today. Maybe Thomas had been there when they nailed Jesus to the cross. Maybe he'd seen them shove that spear into his side. Maybe he'd watched as they took down his limp body and wrapped it in cloth and laid it in a cold tomb. Maybe he'd seen it all. And so he knew that dead people don't rise. And so when he heard these reports, there was no way that he was going to be taken in. There are many like Thomas today. One guy said to me in a public debate, "Look, I'm not asking for much. Just one contemporary, scientifically verified miracle, and I'll believe." He was a sort of celebrity atheist that was doing the rounds a little bit. He said, "Look, it doesn't even need to be a big one. Paul, why don't you just pray now? Ask God to heal one child of cancer. And if the scientists say it's happened, then I'll become a Christian." Others say, "Look, I'm open-minded. Of course I would believe. If only God would make himself just a little bit clearer to me." And it all sounds so reasonable. But in all those cases, the issue is not how someone says that they would respond if they got the evidence that they are demanding. The question is, how are they already responding to the evidence that God has already given them? It may surprise us to know that the game of going around the world doing private little magic shows to try and persuade people to believe, as though he's some sort of desperate salesman who will go out of business unless he gets our trade. Actually, he's already given us all of the evidence that we need to believe in Jesus with confidence and with complete integrity of mind. And that's our second point this evening, as we move from reasonable doubt to persuasive evidence. We cut to the scene in the same room a week later, and Thomas is there this time in the next paragraph. Who knows what he's saying? "Look, I told you all, it's been a week already. Dead men don't rise." Verse 26 this time, if you glance down. 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. And put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Incontrovertible, tangible, scientific evidence. There was no denying that Jesus had been dead. And as he stood there in front of Thomas, there was no denying that he was alive again. Notice Jesus didn't say to him, "Stop thinking and believe." He said to him, "Thomas, I'm here. Perform all of the tests that you like and believe." I guess Thomas had seen Jesus' miracles. Maybe he'd seen him feed thousands. He'd seen him raise others from the dead. But it was now, with Jesus standing right in front of him, undeniably, irrefutably, uncontestably raised physically from the dead, that Thomas utters the confession that John wants all of his readers to make our own. Did you see it there in verse 28? "Jesus, you are my Lord and my God." But for me, I think the most striking thing about this little episode is that Jesus didn't just give Thomas what he asked for. He also chided him for needing it. Verse 29, Jesus said to Thomas, "Have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Or in other words, "You've believed because you've seen me, but Thomas, you really shouldn't have needed to, because you already had all of the evidence that you needed." That is to say, you had the reliable testimony of eyewitnesses. Your friends, the disciples, had told you. They'd gone on telling you that they'd seen me alive, and you should have believed them. You see, Thomas knew these men. He'd spent 3 years with them. He knew that they weren't given to telling lies or hallucinations. They were honest men. And so when credible eyewitnesses told Thomas that they'd seen Jesus alive, he should have believed them. And the point of John chapter 20 is that because we have access to that very same reliable eyewitness testimony, then so should we believe as well. if you flick the page to verse 30, you'll see that that explicit point is made. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples which aren't written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Like Thomas, during that first week after Easter, we haven't personally seen the risen Lord Jesus. But just like Thomas, we do have access to the reliable eyewitness testimony of some men who did. Thomas heard their testimony in the flesh. We read it in the pages of the New Testament. But the testimony is the same. These men were men of integrity. They were utterly transformed by their experiences that first Easter. They founded the church off the back of it, and many of them died for their beliefs. And as we read John 20, one of them tells us, Jesus is alive. I saw him. He says, I've written it down so that you can believe. Jesus himself says, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. When you think about it, life is full of things that we believe to be true because we've been told them by other credible people. So I wasn't in the concentration camps, but I believe that the Holocaust happened because I've read the books of credible people. And when someone investigates the Christian faith, we don't ask them to stop thinking. At every point that it gets difficult in the conversation, we don't say, oh, you've just got to have faith. But we do say that if you want to evaluate the Christian faith seriously, you necessarily need to do it by considering the eyewitness evidence of the Bible. There are other good books to read, and we sell them from time to time, but the Bible contains all of the evidence that you need if you're going to investigate the Christian faith. And so one of the questions that this passage of the Bible asks us this evening is, would you be willing to engage with the eyewitness evidence? Some of the family went a while back to London Zoo to see a new gorilla enclosure that's been open for just over a year or so, I think. And they came back running home and they told me about their great delight at seeing Bobby the boy gorilla and a new girl gorilla called Effie who'd been introduced to the enclosure, and how they chatted to all the zookeepers who were hoping that, I'll spare you the gory details of how, the boy gorilla and the girl gorilla might become friends and make a baby gorilla. That's the big hope at London Zoo at the moment. We've got some of the teenagers in, so I won't go into any more detail. But because the people who told me were eyewitnesses, and because they're honest people, I believed what they told me. But imagine if instead of believing them, I'd said, oh, you know, I really admire your faith. But I have to say, I don't believe in gorillas. I'm not that sort of person. But I tell you what, look, I'm open-minded. So if Bobby the boy gorilla were to come round to my house, if he were to mix me a few cocktails and tell me a couple of stories from the jungle, then I would believe because I'm so open-minded. You'd think I'd lost the plot. You'll understand, that wouldn't be because there was no evidence for the existence of Bobby. Actually, I'd already been given plenty of good evidence. It would be that I was refusing to believe in the evidence that I'd already been given, and instead I was demanding a whole new level of proof that could never possibly be satisfied. And you'd have to conclude it was just because I didn't want to believe that he was there. It's a fatuous illustration, but I hope you'll see that I want to encourage you not to do the same thing with the Christian faith. God has revealed himself clearly in Jesus. It's all been written down very clearly in the Bible. He's given us all the evidence that we need. Now, I might want to put the evidence of Jesus in the Bible to one side and say, look, I'm open-minded. If only God would come round to my house and mix a few cocktails and perform a few miracles, then I'd believe. But I shouldn't try and delude myself into thinking that I'm being open-minded in the process. Actually, what I'm doing is deliberately setting aside the evidence that's there and demanding a whole new level of proof. And you'd have to conclude it was because I'd already decided that I don't want to believe. So let me throw out a challenge to you. Will you examine the evidence of the Bible for yourself? We run a course here called Christianity Explored that I think William will mention in a minute. It's been designed for that very purpose. There's a new course starting next Monday. Maybe it will be useful to you to come along. I know some are already planning to do so. The great irony, it seems to me, is that many people use science or reason to reject even the possibility of Jesus' resurrection from the dead. And yet they do so in the most unscientific of ways. I'm told that it was on May the 11th, 1848, that a German missionary called Johannes Redmann became the first European to see Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. And much to his surprise when he got there, he discovered that even though Mount Kilimanjaro sits right on the equator, its peak was covered with thick white snow. And so he came dashing back to the Royal Geographical Society in London, thinking he'd made his name as a society, and told all of them, I have seen snow on the equator. And all of the scientists of the day said, there can't be. In fact, the minutes of the meeting, the chairman of the board called Sir Desborough Cooley. I think Desborough would be a great name. If we ever have an unfortunate accident for number four, then we'll think about Desborough, I think. He turned around to Redmann and said, look, you need your eyes testing. There cannot be snow on the equator. But you'll see with me that clinging to your beliefs like that, even when you're presented with new evidence, is in fact very unscientific. The whole way that science makes progress is to let new data challenge existing beliefs and then, if necessary, to change and update those beliefs. And so we don't expect people to believe that Christianity is true just because a vicar stands up and tells you so. That would be naive and gullible, I think. But at the same time, if one of us or a friend were to reject even the possibility of Christianity being true without being willing to consider the evidence, well, that would be equally sub-intellectual. It wouldn't be the Christian who had lost their mind. Well, let me end where Thomas does. He's presented with persuasive evidence, and to his credit, he doesn't shut his eyes to it when he sees that he was in the wrong. Instead, verse 28, he says, my Lord and my God. It's not a suspension of reason. It's not a blasphemous cry of astonishment. It's a reasoned and logical response to the evidence. More, it's an expression of heartfelt surrender and love. And it expresses the response that Jesus wants from each one of us. As Thomas worships him, my Lord and my God. And so Thomas completed his journey from doubt through evidence to belief and worship. And the obvious question for me to ask is, where have you got to on that journey? Maybe you're still at the stage of doubting. You don't need to be. That would be the message tonight. We may want some sort of personal, physical encounter with the risen Jesus that Thomas had, but we're not going to get it. And the point is, neither do we need it. Thomas saw Jesus so that we wouldn't have to. It was a unique event. And by definition, all unique events are unrepeatable. I've been lucky enough to be there on all of the occasions when Emily's given birth three times now. It's one of the most amazing moments in life. Wouldn't have missed it for the world. But imagine I just popped out for coffee or to phone the relatives and keep them up to speed with where things had got to. And then it all happened a bit fast. So I come back in and there is one of our baby boys. It'd be no use to me saying at that moment, I didn't even think of trying this. Listen, darling, I'd really wanted to watch the whole birth thing. I'd had the camera all set up. I wanted to get it all there. We couldn't just shove him back inside, could we, and then maybe try it all over again? You can see that birth is, by definition, an unrepeatable event. And so was the birth and the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. If I'd been around at the time, I could have seen God. I could have touched him and kicked a football around with him. The trouble is, I was just 2,000 years too late. But that doesn't mean that I don't have access to him, because in the pages of the New Testament, I have exactly that. In the Bible, we have sufficient and compelling evidence to stop doubting and believe. And we're being asked, why wouldn't you do that today? What would stop someone from acknowledging Jesus as their Lord and God today, like Thomas did? It'd be a good question to chat about over coffee if you're willing to do that. While you write down questions for me, it's only fair I put you on the spot as well, I think. I think it would help you to be as specific as you possibly can be. Is there an intellectual question? Well, what is it specifically? Is it a lifestyle thing? Is there something that would hold you back from worshipping Jesus as your Lord and God? You're not being asked to surrender your mind. You're not being asked to stop thinking. You're being asked to follow the evidence. Do not disbelieve, says Jesus, but believe. And if you do, look at the hope that he holds out. Verse 31, you will gain life. You will gain life. That is eternal life in Jesus' name. A friendship with the God who made you that starts now and can never be taken away from you, not even by death itself. Stop doubting, says Jesus, and believe. William.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. Well, we've mentioned the questions. It would be a great help if you have questions, if you're able to fill out those question slips relatively swiftly, and then we'll be able to sort them out, and I'll try and put them together, and then I'll be putting the questions to Paul, just again shortly after 9 o'clock. So if you can, let's have those questions relatively quickly. Paul mentioned the Christian Explored evenings, and just on the table there, if you want to browse, you'll find that there are some little leaflets about the Christian Explored, and you can just have a look at that over pudding as well. So now there's going to be dessert served, and then I'll jump up with Paul and we'll try and have a go at those questions in a few minutes' time. Well, I think if we may, we'll start the questions.
Can I stand on my left with you?
Sure.
I'm unnerved if you stand the other side.
Well, I need to say that I have got here about 20% of the questions. There were a very great deal. I've tried to group them as much as I possibly can. We've already mentioned the Christianity Explored evenings. On those evenings, you can ask any question you like, and it really is an open forum for questions. So if you don't feel you've got your questions answered, then please be quite ready to come back. And,
can I just say on Christianity Explored, sorry to interrupt, that it's advertised on your sheet, I think, as a 7-session thing running on 7 Monday evenings. Actually, the next course is only for 3 Monday evenings. So we're not going to be meeting over Christmas, just 3 Monday evenings. So hopefully that will be a help to some.
When do you start?
And we start next Monday evening.
A week today?
Indeed. Okay. Yeah, a week today.
Okay, now there were lots of questions about, you know, can you arrange a flat share for me and that sort of stuff. I haven't included that. Would you marry me? I take that wasn't a personal question to me. It was a sort of more general affair. Come and talk to me if you want to get married. That'd be very happy to do that. But I'm already married. Okay,
yeah,
we don't do that.
No,
we don't do that here. Okay, so here's the first one. Is it wrong to try and verify the claims of the Bible or check out its facts?
That's an excellent question. To which I think the answer is no. It's not wrong to verify the claims of the Bible, and indeed lots of people have done a great deal of that. That there's been a huge amount of study of sort of archaeology and going back over other Roman and Jewish historical sources to see the extent to which the teaching of the New Testament, and particularly some of the historical claims of the New Testament, are corroborated by the external evidence. And in almost every case, I think, in fact, I couldn't think of a counterexample, but I'm sure there have been some. They've been found to corroborate the things that the New Testament says. I think that the question behind the question, though, is why would someone, if they're wanting to get to the source of the truth, why would someone think that setting aside, and I'm sure we'll have questions about this in a second, some brilliantly attested historical writings, and relying on a little piece of pottery that was dug up that mentioned the name Jesus and may or may not have been referring to Jesus of Nazareth. Why would someone trust that little bit of pottery over and against the historical writings of the New Testament? So it's not wrong to check it out. Indeed, I'd encourage you to do so. But I think to suggest that there is out there somewhere some morally neutral and worldview neutral evidence that you can lay your hands on that would really seal the deal one way or the other about whether or not the Bible's reliable, I think it just wouldn't work historically.
Okay. What about this one? Thomas from Yorkshire writes, and I won't try and mimic him, but rather than the public adopting an a priori sceptical perspective towards Christianity, isn't it more of an apathetic approach to religious matters specifically and spiritually in general? It's a lack of considered thought to this issue, not blind scepticism or faith.
Thank you. Well, I guess we'll know after tonight. I'm sure it is the case that there is a huge amount of apathy out there. I wonder if the general mood within our, which I think is still there within our media and within our culture, that all of the modern findings and the Da Vinci Code and everything else has disproved Christianity, feeds the apathy somewhat. But the way that you can tell with a particular individual whether it's apathy or a cynicism and refusal to engage with the evidence is how they respond to an encouragement to do so. So I think if someone were to go away from here tonight, for example, and say, I still simply refuse to even begin to ask the question and start to engage with the evidence, then we would know that that person wasn't particularly concerned about evidence, I think. We would know that that person has just made an a priori decision to reject the claims.
Okay, thank you. I want to keep moving because I want to get right through as many as we can here. Assume God does not exist, assume the Bible is just an invented story, your whole chain of evidence could then be interpreted exactly the other way around. Inversion of your root assumption proves the non-existence of God.
I admire your faith. If you're willing to presume that God doesn't exist in the face of all of the evidence that he does, and you're willing to presume that the Bible is myth, in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary, then I think you have far more blind faith than Christians do. I'm not asking you to buy into an assumption of the existence of God or to buy into an assumption of the truth of the New Testament documents. I'm encouraging you to proceed with historical inquiry like you would about anything else. If you'd sat under a history professor at university who denied that the Holocaust happened and you wanted to get to the root of things for yourself, I guess you would listen carefully to his arguments, but you would then want to gather all sorts of competing arguments from other professors rather than just taking one person's word for it. You'd want to examine all of the different bits of evidence and then come to a reasoned conclusion in the light of the totality of the evidence. And we'd encourage you to do something similar. By all means, read as many of the writings of Richard Dawkins as you can be prepared to wade through, and other atheistic writers who try to disprove and discredit Christianity. We'd encourage you to read those. But don't simply read on one side of the debate. why not engage with those who appear to be learned, are equally scientifically credible as Richard Dawkins, and yet maintain belief in Jesus Christ as Lord and God?
Okay, that moves us very neatly on to the eyewitnesses. So how can John be an eyewitness account? I thought no one really knows who wrote John, and it was written too long after Jesus' time in any case. Where did it come from, this eyewitness account?
These are great questions. Thank you. Thank you. actually, we believe that Christianity is true in the fullest and deepest sense of that word, and so we rejoice to have questions, because we think that as we work at them, even if we don't have full answers to them tonight, that they will authenticate the truth claim of Christianity as we look at them more deeply. Who was John? Actually, I think there's good reason from within John's gospel for believing that John was written by an eyewitness. So let me just give you one example. In the very first page, why don't you turn there, actually, the very first page, which is chapter 1 of John and is on page 3. Verse 14 says, speaking of Jesus, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." It's one of quite a few instances in John's Gospel where the author includes himself among those who have seen Jesus Christ in the flesh right in front of them. So there are scholars who have doubted that whether or not John himself, the apostle, a friend of Jesus, wrote John's Gospel within his lifetime. Some of that doubt, in all honesty, began from a belief that John's Gospel was written sometime in the second century, late in the second century, and couldn't therefore have been written by an eyewitness. I think there are good reasons to believe, and indeed the scholarship seems to bring it earlier and earlier all the time, to think that John was written at the latest in the 80s, possibly early 90s, could be as early as the 60s AD, the late 60s AD. And so there's no good reason, I think, historically to believe that John wasn't written down within the lifetime of one of the eyewitnesses. Throughout John, there's reference made to a beloved disciple, one of Jesus's inner circle, and the three in the inner circle were Peter, James, and John. And this reference to the beloved disciple seems to tie in with instances of the apostle John, good friend of Jesus. And so I think there's good reason to believe that, although some scholars have doubted it, that this book was written by a mate of Jesus.
Well, saying, isn't it, too, that it actually reads like eyewitness material. And interestingly, I think C.S. Lewis says that that kind of style of writing, historical narrative, the historical fiction, wasn't invented for something like 1700 years after this. Whereas it, and therefore, you know, it'd be quite extraordinary to think they'd invented something out of the blue that was never then seen again as a piece of writing. So.
Thank you. And certainly the external evidence would corroborate the notion that John was the author, the friend of Jesus. So we were just trying to remember the date that a chap called Irenaeus was writing. We think it was about 170 AD. He quotes from one of the early bishops in the church. He quotes from John's Gospel and attributes it, as we know it, and attributes it to John. And then much earlier as well, we couldn't quite remember the exact date. We think it was around 108, a chap called Polycarp and a couple of others whose names have gone from my memory.
Clement,
we think. And
Clement and Polycarp. Clement and Polycarp are the two.
We're writing it very early in the second century and quoting from the vast majority of the books in the New Testament and ascribing them to the authors as we know them today.
Thanks, Paul. I want to keep on the Bible because so much of it seemed to be based on that. Should the Bible be taken literally? What do you have proof that the Bible is fact? Or do you simply believe the Bible is fact?
Should it be taken literally? It should be taken in the way that a particular passage of the Bible was intended. So when you come across love poetry in the Bible, and a chap falling over himself to express the beauty of the woman that he loves. One's not supposing that you would read that document in exactly the same way that you read some of the laws from ancient Israel, or in the same way that you would read a letter or a piece of historical prose. So according to the kind of writing, so it is to be understood. Certainly the New Testament authors, particularly in the Gospels, were in no doubt that they were writing down that which they had seen and that which had really happened. They very clearly make that point. And John, who wrote this this book, also wrote a couple of the letters in the New Testament. And at the start of one of them, he explains how the things that he had spent his life proclaiming are the things that he had seen and the things that he'd heard and the thing that he had touched. Speaking of Jesus himself, risen from the dead, he's saying, it's exactly what we saw that we have proclaimed to you. The whole of Christianity was based on the historical events of Jesus Christ. And so they went to great lengths to try and write it down accurately, because they wanted succeeding generations to be able to believe in a compelling way in that which had happened.
Great, thank you. And last couple on the Bible now. Errors in translation, distortion, and hasn't the Bible been changed? So how can we trust it?
Thank you. The whole realm of scholarship known as textual criticism that draws together all of the different manuscripts. Over 24,000 now have been found around the place and pieces together the New Testament back in its original Greek language. And they check them all against one another to try and make sure that as you put it together, we know exactly what they wrote. They're now confident that with 99% of the New Testament writings, we can know exactly that which was written down and that it has been preserved accurately. Which is not to say that we can only be 99% sure about all of the New Testament, because we know where the 1% is. So what the scholars are claiming is that we can be 100% confident about 99% of the New Testament, that what we have today is that which was written in the first century. And the 1%, no major Christian doctrine hangs on it. And indeed, when you read a modern translation, you'll see that often there are footnotes in it, and that's where the 1% is. So that as you read a modern translation, all translation is treason. There are some places that you think, as you look at it and you study the original languages, yeah, maybe they could have worded that differently. But what you have is an excellent and accurate modern translation of that which was originally written in the first century. So I'd encourage you to take it away and read it. It's ultimately self-authenticating in that way.
Good, okay. Now, isn't the evidence for the other religions just as strong? What makes the testimony of the disciples so reliable and the testimony text of other religions unreliable? How do you explain competing or other religions?
We're getting them all tonight, aren't we? This is great. Interesting, just in comparison to other religions, the eyewitness account, or the accounts about the life of the founder of the religion spring up remarkably early in Christianity. So 30 to 50 years max after the life of Jesus, the New Testament Gospels were being written down. The letters started being written just 10 years after the events of Jesus' death and resurrection. So very, very early. But with Islam, the earliest account of the life of Muhammad springs up 125 years after Muhammad's life. And it then goes on being edited for another 50 years after the event. With Gautama Buddha, it's something like 350 years after his birth that you have the first records of his life being drawn up. So the Gospels attesting to the identity of Jesus arrive remarkably early. On the competing claims of the different religions, it's actually wonderfully simple, because all of the different religions of the world make competing and mutually exclusive truth claims about the answer to the question, who was Jesus of Nazareth? Okay? So every world religion has an answer to the question, who was Jesus, that they claim to be historically true, and they disagree with each other about it. So in Judaism, Jesus is either a prophet or a heretic, depending on the branch of Judaism. In Islam, Jesus is understood to be a sinless prophet, but definitely less than God. In Buddhism, there's no belief in God, so Jesus is understood to be an enlightened man, but no different in potential to the rest of us. In Hinduism, he's understood to be either, again, depending on who you talk to, one God among millions, or one face of the one true God among millions of different faces that there are out there. Only in Christianity is Jesus understood to be God on earth. So as you investigate the key question at the heart of Christianity, who was Jesus? Not only as you consider the evidence for his resurrection, his miracles, and everything else written in the New Testament, not only do you come to a clear mind about Christianity itself, but in so doing, you also come to a clear mind about all of the other world religions. If the evidence of history were to suggest that Jesus is just a good man and no more, then you could write off Christianity as being false. If it were to suggest that Jesus is a sinless prophet, a spokesman of God, but definitely not God, then Islam would be right in that respect at least, and Christianity would be wrong. But if the evidence of history were to persuade you that Jesus is in fact God, as Thomas understood him to be, my Lord and my God, then in one fell swoop, you will have not only proven the truth of Christianity itself, but you will have disproved all of the other competing world faiths who disagree with that conclusion. So the key question that I'd love you to go away mulling on is, who was Jesus Christ? Do you have a good answer to that? Do you believe what you believe in answer to that question on the strength of evidence, or on the strength of something that you picked up along the way? Test the evidence, please. Who was Jesus?
Thank you. Okay, well, just one question on the cross, and I thought we'd tackle this for a moment. How can you have a sound belief to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, when God, his Father, sent into earth to be cruelly murdered? What father would commit such cruelty to his son? Where is the compassion and love in this act of cruelty?
Thank you. If the son were an unwilling participant in his death on the cross, then it would be horribly cruel for any father to inflict punishment upon his son. But the way that the Bible presents Jesus, in fact in the Gospels itself, is that he was, not only did he share in the decision-making process that he should come and die on the cross, but also that at every moment along the way he willingly submitted himself to that death. Famously, the night before he died in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus is wrangling with what's going to happen. Lord, if it's possible, please take this cup away from me. Yet, not my will, but yours be done. As in glad submission to his Father in heaven, the Son freely chooses to go and die. Where's the love and compassion in that? It's demonstrated in the people for whom Father and Son were willing that the Son should die. So the only way that any human being could ever be restored to the friendship with God for which we were designed, but from which each one of us has turned away to a greater or lesser extent, and in different ways, the only way that anyone could ever be restored to relationship with God, the New Testament teaches, and I wish we had longer to explain it. In fact, I'm speaking about it on Sunday morning here, 10:30, if you'd like to come, was through the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. So Father and Son freely choose that the Son should go to the cross and die, so that people who don't deserve it, who have rejected God like us, should have the possibility of being restored to friendship with God. And you can only say that that is astonishing love and boundless compassion when you consider the nature of us and the way that we have treated him.
Thank you. I think we've got about five more minutes. And I'd like to ask you five more questions. So do you think we're up for that?
Great.
We can run to that. You can see the gorillas at the zoo. You can speak to Holocaust survivors about their experience. Can you really compare this to evidence of God's existence?
Again, we're back on the reliability of the New Testament evidence. The questions are, could the people who saw it write it down accurately? And I think when you understand something of the oral culture of the day, about which we could speak at greater length, and you understand something of the passion with which they held their beliefs about Jesus Christ, and you understand the relatively short time frame, you think, well, yeah, they could have written it down accurately. Did they intend to write it down accurately? Yes, they intended to write it down accurately. They tell us so. Did they write it down accurately? Well, insofar as we've been able to corroborate it, yes, they did write it down accurately. And therefore, the burden of proof, I think, shifts from those who believe in the historical integrity of the New Testament documents onto those who would doubt it. Have you got good reason to disbelieve the things that are written in the New Testament about Jesus? They could write down accurate history. They intended to, and so far as we can tell, they did. Why would someone not believe that which they've written?
Thank you, Paul, very much. I think this is a really excellent question. I didn't write it myself. You spoke of a journey from doubt through evidence to belief. If evidence and reason will take you the full distance on that journey, then what is the role of faith? And then, I'm not sure if this is a question or a statement, if faith has any role, surely it must be that the final bridge on that journey, achieving what evidence and reason cannot, is that not losing your mind?
I don't think so, because faith, as the Bible presents it, is in language of trust. It's in language of acknowledging the things that the New Testament says are true, to be true. Now, mathematically, you cannot prove any historical event. It just doesn't work like that. In fact, if you get right into the mindset of skepticism, you can't prove anything. And a mathematician helpfully explained to me the core base assumptions that you have to make. I can't remember what he called them. What did he call them? The Peano axioms, that if you don't make those basic assumptions at the center of everything, then even the whole of maths falls apart. So you can't mathematically in that sense prove the Christian faith. What you can do is look at all of the evidence and say, all of this evidence seems to point in the direction that Jesus is Lord and God. Faith in the Bible's terms is in the moment where you move from saying, yes, I can see that the evidence is compelling, to saying, I will now live in the light of that which I've demonstrated to be true. It's when you stop believing something else for which you can now see that there's less evidence, and you start believing the thing for which you now see that there is a great deal of evidence. That's not a blind leap. Faith is an internal, willful acknowledgement of the truth that you've discovered.
Thank you, Paul, very much. Now, a couple of ones on personal. This is all one question, by the way. What personal contact have you had with God which makes you believe? What is eternal life? What does it mean?
Thank you. I'm grateful for the questions, because I'm aware that we've been slightly out there and abstract and theoretical in much of what we've said so far. Eternal life is defined for you in John's Gospel, actually. Perhaps you would turn there with me to chapter 17 on page 49. I'll try and be a minute. John chapter 17, verse 3 on page 49. This is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. So Jesus' definition of eternal life, of being alive, is profoundly relational. It's about knowing God the Father personally, not just knowing facts about him in the way that I might learn historical facts about Alfred the Great or someone, but knowing him personally and knowing Jesus in a I walk through life with him in my life day by day kind of way.
What does that What does that look like or feel like for you, Paul?
It feels difficult sometimes because you're right in saying God remains invisible. It's not that someone becomes a Christian and immediately starts getting big visions every night when they go to bed that in some way confirm the authenticity of this. In some ways, therefore, it is difficult because I'm believing something that I cannot see. But because I'm believing it on the strength of the evidence, it's not fanciful. And the way that it works out in practice is as being, I think, the most real and tangible relationship in my life, that every time as I open the Bible, again, it doesn't always feel brilliant because I'm rubbish and tired when I get up sometimes and so on, but every time I open the Bible, I have confidence that God, the maker of the universe, is speaking to me. And as I pray to him, although sometimes it feels like I'm talking to the ceiling, I have real confidence because of the promises of Jesus that he is listening to me. And as I've walked through life, I've been following him almost 20 years now, he's proven his faithfulness to me day after day in some of the most difficult circumstances in life and some of the happiest circumstances in life. So that the Christian doesn't want just to say, I know stuff about God, but they say, here is a relationship which has, it's like turned on the color in my life. If before I was living in black and white, here is every relationship I'm now in, every experience of the world that I'm now in is now technicolor in a way that before it wasn't. Because now, the God who made me and for whom I was designed to live is involved in every relationship and every experience of the world. So let's turn the lights on, I think.
I think we'll make this the last one. Okay. If I believe Jesus rose from the dead, does that make me a Christian? A. Second question. Accepting the fact that Jesus existed, what do we learn about Christianity from this fact? What response does it demand of us?
Thank you. You could believe intellectually in the resurrection of Jesus from the dead and not be a Christian. Indeed, the Bible says that the devil believes all of the things that we've said tonight. But still, because he refuses to acknowledge Jesus as Lord and God in the way that Thomas did, well, he's not a Christian. So it's not enough merely to be persuaded intellectually after you've asked all of your questions. It is about that personal acknowledgement, bowing the knee, as it were, which leads us into the what is the response that I'm called of. I'm called to respond in exactly the way that Thomas did, to come to Jesus and say, Jesus, I know that up until now in my life, I have not lived with you as my Lord and God. It's true that to say that I've lived my life and the person on the throne, as it were, the King, the Lord, the God who's called the shots has not been you but has been me. And I see now that if the reality of the universe is that you are in fact Lord and God and I am not, then I've been wrong to disregard you in that way. Would you forgive me? And please would you help me now in my life as I acknowledge you as my Lord and God, would you help me to do so more and more, to live for you, to surrender my everything to you, to, as it were, be on my knees before you, Jesus, giving you the recognition in my life that I deserve, my Lord and my God. We wouldn't want to encourage someone to do that without first being sure that Jesus is Lord and God. But what we would desperately hope that someone wouldn't do would be to sit there saying, well, yeah, I believe this stuff. Historically, I'm sure it's right. He is Lord and God. I buy that. But then to go through life in what Richard Dawkins calls practical atheism, going through life theoretically believing that he's Lord and God, but in practice disregarding his existence in my day-to-day living. That'd be a crazy position to be in, because that would be to live a lie, and a lie for which God himself will hold you to account one day. So we would encourage you to be, metaphorically at least, on your knees before Jesus my Lord and my God.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. Why don't you take a seat? That's very helpful. Thank you. Just that concludes our evening together. It remains for me to say a big thank you to Paul, an even bigger thank you to the servers who are part of the church family here and have been serving us, and the cooks. Many thanks. And a big thank you to you for coming. Really glad you've taken the evening out. As I say, we run evenings like this from time to time. There's the Christian Explore course, which you've had a chance to have a look at. Do think about coming next Monday. You could come for just 1 week and then try it out, see what it's like. I have to say, we won't have quite this sort of setup next week, but it'll be a very enjoyable evening and well worth coming along. We'd love you to come and join us on a Sunday. It's a very relaxed, informal sort of environment. Sunday at 10:30 and Sunday at 6 in the evening. Again, lots of people come who haven't been in a church for years and years and find themselves quite at home and able to join with us. So do come and do that. 10:30 on a Sunday morning, 6 o'clock on a Sunday evening. The other thing to say is, as you go out, on the table, just on your right as you go out, you'll find some people who are involved in the Christianity Explored evenings. They can answer any question you've got. They've got one or two bits of material there that you might like to have a browse over and look at. And if you've decided now, look, actually, I'd like to come along next Monday, it'd be great help if you just let them know, or dropped a slip in the bin, I think, at the back there as you go out, and then we will know to cook for you and other things like that. Thank you very much for coming, and we really hope to see you again before too long.